Steve.
What's up, dude?
A Healthy Dose is a bi-weekly podcast hosted by Steve Krause, healthcare partner at Bessemer Venture Partners, and Trevor Price, CEO of Oxygen Partners.
Money talks, but it don't sing and dance and it don't walk.
The guys talk to leaders from various aspects of healthcare and cover personal stories, entrepreneurship, investing, and have a few laughs, many at each other's expense.
Well, we both enjoy the art of the conversation. We both have faces that are made for radio. So
at least eyebrows for me.
Double chin for me.
We get a lot of ones right, but we get a lot of ones wrong.
One of the most interesting conversations I've had in a long time.
If you pardon me, I'd like to say we do okay forever in blue jeans.
On this episode of A Healthy Dose, Trevor and Steve sit down with Owen Tripp, co-founder and CEO of Grand Rounds.
Baby, tonight by the fire, all alone.
So Steve, we've done a whole bunch of these Healthy Dose podcasts, and some of them are like pretty Q&A based conversations where we ask a question and then we get an answer and we might rip off of it. I thought this one was really unique because I've had the fortune to know Owen Tripp, founder and CEO of Grand Rounds, for a number of years now, and really enjoy the both the professional and personal relationship I have with him. I don't think you knew him. And so what was interesting in...
I know Owen. Remember, he was the CEO of a Bessemer back portfolio company before Grand Rounds. So, or not CEO, the founder and COO.
Got it. Because what was so interesting is it was like one of the most conversational back and forths that I think we've had, where it was just like everyone was kind of riffing off each other. And I thought the dynamic was really cool. Yeah.
Totally. It's what we wanted when we set out, you know, shooting the shit around the bar or the table. He was fit in perfect. In fact, Trevor, we better watch out. If Owen might take our jobs as podcast celebrities if we let him do this too much. He was better than us on this podcast. I really enjoyed the conversation.
He also could probably take our jobs as venture capitalist and executive search consultant.
Clean our clock. Yeah. That's right. We're going to be disrupted by Owen Tripp.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Grand Rounds is a really interesting company. He's probably one of the early fellows who came from tech. He did have a little healthcare background, as he explains in the podcast, but his previous company was a tech-focused company and really came into healthcare. And, you know, he's built a real scaled enterprise company. Grand Rounds' mission is originally was focused on, you know, providing second opinions.
You also get very clearly why he's been ranked, you know, one of, if not the top CEOs to work for in healthcare. He's just fundamentally a great guy. And I think his humanity and humility come across. I think he was kind enough to talk to us about how he was a Grand Rounds customer himself and what he's gone through and, you know, his perspective having stepped into a healthcare company from being at eBay and reputation.com and then taking over healthcare companies really invaluable. And I think hopefully we see more Owen Tripps coming from the tech and outside of healthcare industries and coming in and shaking up healthcare. And so it was a good one. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, really good one. I think listeners will enjoy it. There's a lot on that transition from tech to healthcare, and he's very candid about the state of the industry. So lots of good stuff here to listen to. Hope you enjoyed the podcast about.
All right. So really, I'm super psyched to do this podcast with Owen. I want to disclose something. I remember first hearing about Owen and Grand Rounds was probably 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And I looked at the website and I looked at Owen's background. I was like, what the fuck is this all about? Like, who is this guy? And what is this company? And I was dead wrong. And so it's super nice to have Owen here because we're going to talk about what it takes for someone who has spent a good portion of their entrepreneurial career actually outside of healthcare to step into a business and become a successful healthcare CEO. And so it's nice to have you here. And I wanted to start out by acknowledging.
I like any podcast where Trevor has to admit that he's wrong. That's
apology?
A great start.
That was an apology.
Reputation.com and PayPal. And what are you going to do to second opinions?
It's funny. The first time
tell
I met
who the
Trevor.
Backers of Reputation.com.
Yeah, exactly. BBB.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Wait to insult both Owen and Bessemer Venture Partners in your opening salvo.
Let's start over.
No, let's keep it.
The first time we met, I actually remember you coming across that way a little bit. And I was like, who is this guy? You know, this guy's supposed to be in the consulting service industry. And I have to convince him why my business is interesting. But I got to admit, kind of like that a little bit. I like the hard to get. I'm like, no, really, this is a great opportunity. Let me tell you.
Let's start all the way back. We've had some unbelievable stories told about formative experiences, formative kind of developmental journeys that people have gone through as a result of their parents, as a result of their upbringing. What created you? How did you become who you are?
Yeah, complicated story, I'm sure. Not sure I could probably nail it in this format, but what I'll tell you, there are a few things that really mattered as I think about Grand Rounds today that I can trace back.
Yeah.
One, grew up middle kid in a professional middle class New England family, kind of all the trappings of that New England family, a lot of hard work, a lot of emphasis on education. But mostly I think back and I look at my mom and my dad, and they were both oriented towards social good, social problems that could be solved. My dad, town physician, local pediatrician, after church when we were out getting donuts or whatever, everybody would stop him. They'd tell them about their families, their troubles. They'd expect him to kind of minister to them, not just for the medical stuff, but like, hey, how would you solve this problem, Dr. Tripp? How would you think about this life choice I have to make? And then my mom, public school educator, really kind of the systems thinker in my family. She was a superintendent, assistant superintendent of schools. I don't think either one of them was super interested in technology, which I ultimately became, you know, obsessed with, even at a very early age.
Did you know you were going to be like an entrepreneur? What did you think you were going to be when you were a young kid? Do you have any view?
I think I thought I was going to be a doctor for a while, just because I just idolized my dad.
Your dad was so cool.
He really wasn't that cool, actually. I hope he never listens to this podcast. But he was so cerebral, so awesome, so genuine that he was cool. You know, he was wearing, you know, pleated pants long past their prime and, you know, the Save the Children ties with big coffee stains on them and stuff like that. But he was cool, at least to me, for the things that he could do and the way people would trust him and the way that he would never betray their trust, at least never that I saw.
Did you start, you went to a liberal arts college. Did you start your career? I think you were at Accenture coming out of college. Is that right? In health and life sciences?
Yeah.
Did you actually work in your dad's practice ever?
No, I never did. But what I did do is I trained to be an EMT and then worked as an EMT in college. And I'll tell you, that is a terrible way to get introduced to the medical system. I think it's great for action junkies. It's very physical activity.
Quick trivia question. Who's the other healthcare?
Jonathan Bush. Yeah. It was a good introduction to the healthcare system. Ultimately, it's kind of a depressing introduction to the healthcare system because you see a lot of people being taxied around in ambulances that frankly should have a different point of access to the healthcare system. And frankly, you're doing the same pickups of the same people, and that's really a bummer. So I worked in the computer center and I worked writing code, actually. It was the first time I started to build, you know, simple websites to help people learn different languages. And I was not a computer science major, but I was really excited by what you could do with technology. And that gave me my first taste of what
it was. And this was not to age you, but this was late 90s, early 2000s
that
you
were doing this? Yeah, it was early. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yep. So there's a lot of, I mean, everyone is talking about B2B exchanges and, you know, just changing the way everyone does commerce at that point in time. So that you are
exactly,
you are being influenced by that in Hartford, Connecticut.
Yeah, well, this is the ultimate center of technology.
No, Trinity College, the ultimate center.
Here's what I was a
computer science
major. You got
major.
Two Hartford, Connecticut guys here. You better watch out. Yeah.
Are you from Hartford as well?
I'm from Hartford.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Here's where I will give Trinity a lot of credit. We had ubiquitous Wi-Fi on campus in the late 90s. That did not exist until decades later. And they had gotten some grant money to be able to do that. And, you know, I was on the edge of the generation where not only did we all have email addresses, but we actually had internet in the room, which went from being this thing that you could get at the computer center. You got internet in the room and then you had internet around campus, which meant that a lot of the ways that you experienced and explored and researched were fundamentally through the internet. Mm-hmm. I think the people who grew up on the other side of that generation just have a fundamental orientation to the power of technology than the ones before it.
I completely agree with that.
I'm before it.
That's the point I was trying to make.
Totally. Exactly. So you go into health and life sciences at, you know, an amazing training ground. I mean, Accenture is just a pretty incredible organization. Did you think you were doing that for a couple of years and going into med school, or are you at that point in time, you're bitten by technology?
I think I was bitten by technology. I think the EMT experience made me not want to do the doctor thing. Mm-hmm. And I loved Accenture's global feeling. I loved that I could walk into an office in Singapore or Krakow, Poland, or wherever I was and have that same Accenture global vibe. I just got intoxicated by the power of scale.
Where are we based?
Ultimately, most of my time was actually in Southeast Asia, building big business process outsourcing centers. We took a bunch of work offshore for Aetna and then United and basically replicated.
The Philippines, right?
Yep.
What was that like?
Well, I think, and this leads me to why I ultimately left Accenture. Accenture, amazing training and work with some phenomenal colleagues. But really what my job was fundamentally was to go learn somebody's business in the United States, write it all down, think about process efficiencies, and then teach people how to do it in the Philippines. And it was good work practice skill, but I did not find the work very satisfying because I understood kind of what was going to happen to that group of Americans that I was talking to. And then ultimately, two of my clients visiting the Philippines for the first time, they had never left the country. They were from Ohio. Never left the United States, let alone gone to Southeast Asia. And they were in a hotel one night and there was a coup in the Philippines and their hotel got taken over by the equivalent of the Philippine Army Rangers. And like booby traps all over the building. They were told that the building would explode if they ever left. Men walking around with AK-47s. And I had to help calm these people down because I was the only point of contact that they had. I was in Tokyo on my way back to the Philippines and it was a wild experience.
Wow.
You know,
you still in touch with them?
No.
I'm leaving any
that's,
job.
That's probably a
booby
longer,
traps involved.
That's probably a longer story. Yeah. It ended well in a weird twist of history. The guy who was five levels up for me that I had to call to explain what was going on that night was Tom Spann. Who obviously went on to found Accolade. And so it's wild. But a bunch of us were interested in that. I think that was what ultimately made me look at the work we were doing. Very proud of it. Very proud of the scaling. But I was interested in getting back to a kind of smaller organization and a more technology-focused organization.
So how'd you do that? Like, so your jump, I think, was to go to San Francisco and work for eBay, right?
Right. Exactly. And I regret not taking that
Were they
jump
hiring a lot of health earlier and life sciences people out of Accenture?
That was exactly.
From the Philippines?
The eBay playbook at the time was, how do we get people from the Philippines to come
I
work on
I would love
this?
To see that email or letter that Owen sent. Like, I'm in the Philippines doing large-scale BPO.
Stop me if you've heard this story before.
Exactly.
So, no, actually, it was a friend of mine from Hartford who had made that jump, and she was in a core kind of technology job, and she just put in a kind word for me. I don't think they would have looked at me. And I relocated kind of on a whim, and I'll tell you, that was the most awesome experience. I think I learned everything that I know about community, about network effects businesses, about culture in
what was it like then? So eBay's, I mean, it's glory days. It's real glory days were in the 90s, right? It's survived and is actually thriving through the dot-com bust, so it's proven that it's a sustainable business.
At that time, actually, I would say we were 2 or 3 years prior to the eBay zenith. And so at the time, the key metric, and I love this, was what percentage of internet GDP were we at that time? We were way bigger than Amazon. I mean, people can't remember these days.
Oh, yeah, right.
eBay measured itself in GDP of the internet. We were 24% of the kind of quote-unquote GDP of the internet. And we were focused on all sorts of new experiences. We were buying Skype, which, you know, you can kind of question whether that was super logical. We were investing in Mercado Libre. We bought apartments.com. We bought rent.com. We bought all these different properties. Craigslist, we made a large minority investment.
By the way, it tells you how big eBay was then, but also how small the internet was.
Totally.
In terms of like the fact that you're 24% of the internet at that time.
Absolutely. I mean, that's right. Because commerce was really just coming online. And eBay, you know, was an amazing training ground for product and, as I said, for community and for networks. We had to think about feedback and reputation systems that very much influenced the work that I went on to do at reputation.com. It influences how we think about our reputation systems at Grand Rounds, which is core to the DNA of our company.
What did you take from eBay?
I think I took the power of network effect businesses. That was kind of lesson number one, that if you could find ways to amp up the trust and safety for one side of an audience and make it really meaningful for them, you actually could just naturally start to build the excitement and the energy on the other side. So, you know, even in the relatively short period of time that I was at eBay, I saw us charging up the sellers and I saw us charging up the buyers and thinking about ways to kind of just increase and catalyze the commerce that was flowing between the two of them, which in retrospect seems really easy. We now have Airbnb and we have all these other, you know, kind of trust-based systems. But that was, nobody was doing that. I mean, the notion that I could send Steve something in the mail, never meet him, really have no reference for who he was, no credit report on him, and that we would exchange dollars and that the product would arrive as described and on time, it was radical. And so that was probably the biggest takeaway. That plus the network. I mean, phenomenal people that went on to be the product leaders at LinkedIn. I mean, LinkedIn, I think, came out of the product DNA at eBay. Mm-hmm. Facebook today has a lot of former eBay people. And then the PayPal people have gone on, obviously, as you noticed, to start a bunch of
companies. You want to focus a lot on your entrepreneurial experiences, but you, I think you then went to graduate school, to business school, is that right?
Right, exactly.
So that's pretty passe nowadays, you know, like it's almost like a faux pas or, you know, a scarlet letter in Silicon Valley. You obviously have an MBA, you're obviously a very successful entrepreneur. Yeah. Like, what's your view on the value of an MBA?
Is I've just spent the last 2 weekends writing letters of recommendation for business school.
So I think if you want to start a business, it's not only not necessary, it actually may dampen your ambition to do it. And it certainly will teach you all about all the risk in the world you didn't even realize existed.
And
that part, I think, is negative. And that's why actually...
Well, you feel about all your classmates' fancy lifestyles, too.
Totally. Absolutely. You're right. The private equity guys who are doing activities and affording things that I had never even heard of. You're absolutely right. And I don't know exactly the data on this, but if you just compare the MBA entrepreneurs and their outcomes relative to the non-MBA entrepreneurs, I think the non-MBA entrepreneurs
crush them.
And so, you know, that was always in our head. And the faculty at Stanford would say things like that, which for me sitting in the classroom, just feeling like I needed some basic vocational skills to get out there was a bummer. But then became that kind of chip on his shoulder to say, I'm going to go prove them wrong. And I almost dropped out of the GSB between my first and second year, very close, because Reputation.com was starting to take off, which we had founded in my first year at the GSB. I went from eBay to the GSB thinking that I needed to learn finance skills and all this other stuff. You don't need to learn any of that. If you have good product instincts and you know how to talk to people, and most importantly, you have passion for a particular idea, you can just go do it.
Sounds like in hindsight, you might not have gone.
At all to the GSB?
Yeah.
I think that's probably true. It's an amazing, I think in hindsight.
It's an amazing institution. But
hindsight right now, I'd agree with you. I think 30 years from now, I will look back and be really glad of those connections.
Yeah.
It's a very rich network.
Yeah, you have great classmates.
It's an amazing place. I have great classmates. You get to work with some of them.
Yeah.
It's a terrific cultural place. It teaches people how to think about leadership, I think, in a very kind of ethical and moral way.
What was the kernel idea behind Reputation.com? How did it happen?
Yeah, so first of all, I had great colleagues in that business too. It was another place where you look back and three or four of the guys that I worked with have gone on to start and run their own businesses, which is really cool. And basically the kernel idea was we saw a rising tide of user-generated content. We also saw the internet as the primary reference tool. So if I wanted to learn about Trevor Price, it was as simple as keying his name into a Google search box, and everything I needed to know about him, good or bad, was right there.
By the way, the search results are very scary.
Yeah, terrifying.
I'm literally nauseous right now.
And that has been true today. We predicted in 2006 that your path to getting a job, the path to getting married, the path to getting into college would be in some way inflected by what people learn about you.
It's gonna be even more true 10 years from now.
Yeah.
Because like we were internet sophisticated, but now these people are like born native digital users, right? I mean, the younger generation, they can't get off social media. So I can't imagine 10 years from now, the impact that posts that they had earlier in their life is gonna negatively make on their career.
So storage is now basically cost nothing.
Free, yeah.
Search is basically infinitely scalable. And so our thesis was that would be your resume. That would be your digital handshake.
Totally.
Everything anybody would need to know about you, they would discover through the internet. So you needed proactive monitoring, you needed proactive remediation tools when you had them, and that was the thesis. It was a damn good thesis. If I look back, and that business, you know, still going, still cranking, customers in 100 countries, nice new enterprise business, which they've invented, frankly, after I left.
Some in healthcare, by the way.
Yeah, and with a big focus in healthcare and some healthcare investors.
Yeah.
I think on the personal side of the business, we were probably a little bit early. We were a little bit early to the tool set and the communications that people wanted to be able to have for an individual. I actually still think that would be a good idea today.
And you guys raised money, obviously.
From really brilliant investors.
Was that your first process of having raised venture capital? Because we're going to get to raising money around Grand Rounds, which you've been incredibly successful at. Was it foundational at Reputation? Did you learn that there?
Yep. It was foundational at Reputation. And I think the most foundational of those lessons was in 2008. So we had great investors. We had Mike Maples from Floodgate as our angel. We had David Cowan from Bessemer, who's a brilliant guy. And we had Ted Schlein from Kleiner, another brilliant guy. So we had doubled the business going into the late 2008 investing cycle and doubled our revenue. And we could not get somebody to give us money. And they would say things like, well, you know, we'll give you a flat to down round just because you're a good business. But like, honestly, the leverage is on this side of the table, and it's kind of a take it or leave it. And I remember being super bummed out about that.
Yeah.
I'm less emotional about that now, and it probably explains some of the activity on the Grand Round side, because these are markets. There are cycles. You have to get capital when capital is available to you, and you have to think about the long run of your business, and you have to be super smart about how you deploy that capital, because the next round may not be there, even if you're a good business.
Yep. It is interesting. I hadn't ever thought about the reputation experience and how it shaped, obviously, naturally, how could it not, you as you went into a very attractive cycle for entrepreneur, and you've got a great business, but you have been very prolific about raising money. And I totally get why, which is, I agree, if you can raise it at prices that are attractive and buffer your balance sheet, you can weather a lot of storms, you can invest in a lot of success, right?
Yeah, I remember being absolutely crushed by that experience back in 2008. Yeah. My co-founder Michael and I drank our faces off after like the 30th meeting where somebody was like, yeah, we just can't get there for you guys. Mm. I mean, we literally did the tour of Sandhill, and we had great investors, and we had a great story, and we had great progress, and just couldn't get it done. Wow. We ultimately did get it done, but it was a very long and hard process.
So this is the big jump we wanted to talk to you about. So you've never been a CEO at this stage. You've done an Accenture run, but then you've really been doing tech businesses in Silicon Valley.
You've been at Reputation for 4 years?
So I was at Reputation for almost 6 years.
And you get called about a business that does second opinions, is building a network of like leading academic physicians,
right,
doing second opinions for self-insured employers.
Even before that. So we talked about that great network from eBay. One of the luminaries was this guy, Michael Deering,
who is
a brilliant kind of orthogonal angel investor. And he and I had remained close over the years. And he runs Harrison Metal. And they were a seed investor in this company called Consulting MD, which was the second after eSecondOpinions.com, which is truly really on the mark for that time.
I can see the hoodie now. eSecondOpinions.com. It wraps around the arm to the other arm.
Exactly.
Do you still own the domain?
We do.
There's a huge secondary market for that domain.
Exactly. Yeah. We just get offers every day. So the interesting thing about that was there really wasn't a business. Consulting MD was actually selling videos of doctors talking about the topics they were interested in. So you can't see Steve right now, but he's just laughing in my face. And I did the same thing basically, because academic doctors, though they are scientifically impeccable, are terrible on camera. So you just see them standing there and there's kind of no expression on their face, and they're talking in a monotone about the fact that peanut allergies are on the rise and these are the things you can do.
Totally.
So it was just not a good product, but yet my co-founder, or who the guy who had become my co-founder, is just an absolutely wonderful human being, charismatic leader for the whole idea that
this is Rusty,
that expertise in medicine was the whole game. And so while the business wasn't dialed in, the seed of the idea that quality matters in healthcare and that expertise can be transformative for families in need was all there. And so what we needed to figure out was a real business, and of course a real team to make that happen.
How much was it influencing you that you got to be a CEO and you felt that that was what you wanted to do at this time?
To this day, you know, I don't know that I really care that much about being a CEO. I really don't. I just like working in great teams and making impact. And there are, you know, some of the greatest meetings when I'm trying to recruit my executive team, and you and I have had versions of this conversation, are those people that you can haul into the business and you're like, hey, if the tables ever turn and I'm just the product guy, or I'm helping on sales or whatever I would be doing, I would be psyched to work for this person.
Yeah.
My personality type is actually the CEO has a lot of downside to it, because I love working in teams. I actually suffer a little bit on the be the guy at the top of the castle, throwing down orders and being, you know, super decisive in the face of confusion.
Yeah.
It's actually, that wasn't the calling card for me. It was the ability to do something that I thought had a ton of purpose with a great guy, and I knew we could figure out the rest.
You made a classic mistake, though, I think, at the beginning, which is you took what was very clearly a product that was needed in the market, and you applied it towards a customer who couldn't pay, being the consumer.
Yep.
Was that like just naivete? Was that where the business was headed?
So it was Rusty's idea and Michael Deering's idea, actually. Michael is a consumer
investor.
And so basically, when we came in, I threw that business out basically immediately. And we started to explore the company-sponsored benefit sort of approach.
Everyone always looks at payers, providers, self-insured employers, or, you know, you immediately went to the benefits.
I think you're giving us way too much credit. I think it was just obvious to Steve's point that we weren't working with a customer who knew how to pay for it or could pay for it or would pay for it. And we didn't even understand all those dynamics that you're pointing to. We just needed to find a source of cash to continue to fund this great product.
How quickly did you pivot that?
We pivoted it almost immediately.
This is the crux of it, though, because you don't have, I mean, I guess from your Accenture days, you might have, but you don't have a ton of experience in what are the economic drivers, what are the levers, why are the business models of payers changing and providers, and why do large, did you know what an ASO was?
No.
Right.
I still don't know what I do know what an ASO is now. Like, but no, so I think, but I did have a natural instinct that, you know, I think the thing I learned at Reputation was generating cash is critical, generating sales is critical. And so it didn't matter how nice the product feedback was about what you were doing. If somebody wasn't going to pay for it, it was not a real business. And so we chased that hard, and I went to my friend's network and I got their companies to sign up, which generated enough case volume to go prove it to the next group and so on and so forth. And then, you know, we find ourselves in meetings with Comcast and Costco trying to prove why this is actually a safe thing for them to be doing. And interestingly, at that time too, we didn't look around to understand that there were other businesses already in this space. I think if we had been deeply knowledgeable about a couple of companies' journeys.
Best Doctors was there, right.
That
was
the Best Doctors
was not, I mean, it obviously got bought by Teladoc. Yeah. We'll talk about that, but you know, it had been around for a long time. It was long in the tooth.
I remember having lunch with Rusty one day, and we had discovered Best Doctors, which I didn't know about joining the business. And he said, they've been started in 1989. He's like, they're doing $80 million in revenue. That's awesome. I'm like, dude, they started in 1989 and they're doing $80 million in revenue. That's awful. Right. I will get fired if that is the story of this business.
Did it help you to not know all the entrenched complexities of healthcare?
I think so.
Like,
although,
because if you had been in healthcare, you would have been like, holy shit, how do we actually sell to self-insured employers?
So I think you can get caught in the mud on all the reasons that it could go wrong and all the people you need to appease to get the rite of passage for healthcare. But on the flip side, and I see this with a lot of people, and I know you two do as well, there are a lot of consumer internet people who come in with incredible arrogance about what they know and what they think they understand about scale. And it's like healthcare is this problem that hadn't been solved until they've really realized that they needed to go solve it themselves. Because nobody smart had ever tried to tackle that problem before.
Yeah.
And I think being more grounded, more down to earth about where the real problems are, and listening to people who have tried some things ahead of you, just makes your solution.
Let me push this, because this is exactly the right point. It's like, it's a really delicate balance, right? Because as someone who's, and now you are too, so is Trevor, deeply steeped in healthcare, you don't want to be dismissive of the new perspective, the new talent, because I think you even said, I heard you once say that if you're too steeped in it, you're going to get stuck, right? You're not going to do the entrepreneurial bold things you need to do, right? And so I always struggle, like, how do you identify someone who's from the outside, probably tech, who's coming into healthcare, who has the right profile to actually be successful?
You know, I would start with how well do they listen, period. I mean, if I were sitting in your chair, because you work with some big personalities, Steve, and I know your partners do too, and you want somebody who's courageous. But I think if they can't tell you one or two people who they respect and have listened to, who've shared some wisdom with them during their journey, then I think that person is going to really struggle. I think you just want somebody who listens incredibly well, but has a filter you trust that they're just going to park a bunch of information that's not valuable.
How much of it, though, goes back to your original point about coming from a mission-driven family with the dad as a physician and mom as an educator?
You know, I don't know. I think the great people who sit in the investor chair can listen and pattern match for the way that you just cognitively work through a problem and how you think through stuff. I'm not sure that the background would have been entirely predictive. And frankly, in those exchanges, when you're going rapid fire with an investor, I'm not sure there's a time really to work through that. I think one of the best choices we made in retrospect was having a healthcare investor on the team early.
You were pretty clear about that at that point, that you were looking for that.
Yeah, and actually, because that's the whole complementing what I don't know. I don't have specific companies in mind when I say this, but I suspect there are a number of ruinous outcomes for really well-intentioned, good entrepreneurs who were paired with somebody who did not appreciate the complexity of healthcare, and then on the board made it really hard for that person to be successful. And so, you know,
well, Brian must have had I mean, having been in Castlight and Athena, I mean, he must have known deeply the institutional sales cycles that you're going to have to go through to prove your business, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
And so many non-healthcare investors don't get that because they're used to consumer tech scaling. And so they force businesses to make really stupid decisions because they're trying to fight through really complex, long sales cycles, right?
Well, he put me in the cage with Sean Levitt early on, who you both know. Yeah. And it was funny because I think at the time, naively, I was like, oh, he's helping me find a customer during the VC process. But he was probably having somebody kick the tires and make sure I wasn't full of you know what. So, you know, ultimately that led to a good outcome. But I think that having the healthcare VCs around is great.
And your B was led by Greylock?
Yeah, so our B was led by Greylock, not a healthcare
not
VC.
Healthcare, yeah.
So I had, you know, Brian kind of anchor awesome VC from the healthcare space. Then Greylock was just a firm that I deeply admired for their ability to create great network effect businesses. And, you know, around that table, you just have, obviously, you know, the story of LinkedIn and Facebook, but you probably don't often think of the story of Redfin, which is another great network effect business. And we're lucky to have the guy from Redfin, James Levitt, on our board today. So really thoughtful, very entrepreneur focused, I should say, firm.
Tell us a little bit about where Grand Rens is today.
Yeah. So core product was the second opinion. We discovered out of that second opinion that 2/3 of the time, our medical experts would say, you need to make a major change in your treatment path going forward. And maybe the diagnosis is right, or maybe it's wrong. 15% of the time we were finding the diagnosis was wrong. But no matter what, the majority of cases we were handling needed a fundamentally different way of thinking about the path forward. Because that was true, we really started to get interested in, what do you do with those patients? Interestingly, right after our raise from Venrock, we took a big chunk of that money and started aggressively investing in the study of physician level performance. Physicians perform like any of us at a very different level, and that when you're in need, you want to be teed up with the perfect match for you. And so all of our product structure, all of the things we've been working on since then has flowed from that kind of central discovery.
Where's the data coming from? Are you?
It's coming from a lot of different places. I mean, we kind of like to think of it being from public data sources. So the liberation of the CMS data has been hugely helpful for us and other sources like that. Part of it is purchase. So we are big acquirers of state administrative claims. We're big acquirers of proprietary data sets from pharma and other places to understand physician performance. And the best stuff is proprietary. You know, we think we're now one of the biggest collectors of medical records in the world. We've just spent a bunch of time and energy on the data science and the rigorous kind of unrelenting study of how do physicians perform.
So and what's the second opinion is a very large spend, big TAM piece of the medical industry, but you're leading me to believe that there's even a bigger play here for Grand Rounds.
Yeah.
What is that?
For sure there is. And so second opinions, and kind of just to spell that out for people who didn't quite track with what you're saying. So second opinions is great, very ROI intensive product, great NPS story. People love using it. The stories you can tell about how you change people's lives, including
they're my own, are
amazing. But a great second opinion company, a category leading, awesome product second opinion company is going to reach 4 or 5% of the population each year.
Right.
And yet our observation is most of the population actually needs to be relocated with the relationships that they're using. And so, yeah, the whole big push now, our second product is Summit, and it's about how do you do clinical navigation on the back of really deep understanding of network performance.
And so, is this steerage?
Well, you can pick your word. No, you can pick your word. No, I don't mind steerage, and I certainly love the underlying concept that there is a right doctor or right team out there for every one of us, but that, frankly, the incumbent solutions that should be teaching us how to find those people are ill-equipped to do it. And what employers are asking us to do now, employers, of course, being kind of our core customer, is to help them redesign how their networks are accessed.
Fascinating. So I've always thought that this idea, you know, that Ryan Roberts backed one of these companies, you know, Castlight, but cost transparency, a lot of money has been put into that in this industry. But I've always thought quality, you know, is the holy grail, like a system that can measure quality, which is really hard. It's really complex.
Yeah. I agree with you. And I think, interestingly, at the physician level is, because there have been measures of hospital quality.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the reality is when you get your knee operated on, it's not HSS operating on your knee. It is the orthopedist who is or is not expert in that sort of knee surgery. And that's the entire game.
So you're working through the self-insured employer to, you know, convince their employees to use Grand Rounds to find the right match. You know, that engagement has been hard for a lot of companies because this is now a real B2B2C business. How have you guys been able to crack that code?
So I'll be honest with you. I don't know that we have, although I think we've done a lot of smart things. And I do think that there are many smart companies out there chasing it. One thing that's kind of worth noting is philosophically, we believe that healthcare is about a physician and a patient taking away pain and suffering.
Point of care is where it all happens. So one company that we actually have had the pleasure of interviewing is Jason from Teladoc.
Sure.
And one of the things that he actually has done, we were impressed, has done really well is the engagement part of, you know, they have really high engagement numbers.
Yeah,
they just acquired Best Doctors.
Yep.
I'm curious, how do you feel about that? I mean, from, you know, in one way it's validation of what you're doing, but another way, I mean, Teladoc's done really well. They're probably one of the most successful performing digital health companies out there. Like, how do you think about that?
I think it's actually a good thing. And I think that principally for the reasons you just said, not just because it's validation of our model, but because smart money is going to push the game forward on a product that really matters and smart minds. Jason is individually one of the guys I most respect. I had talked to him a little bit about how he was thinking about the world beforehand. I think it was a smart move for them. I think there's a lot that they're going to need to figure out, and I know they're working hard on it, about how those two things really make sense with each other and kind of in a continuum. But I have a lot of confidence in those guys.
I feel like every other conversation that I am involved in seemingly is around artificial intelligence, machine learning, et cetera. How much is that a part of this product strategy? Are you using effectively, you talked about data science, but are you using effectively AI techniques to try to figure out what best of care standards are? And are you concerned at all that ultimately, a lot of the secret sauce that you're developing can be almost replicated through AI type products and AI tech? Because like it feels a bit like you got to get out in front of that, or someone could do that and take the best standards of care are and get out in front of what you're doing. Are you at all, does it keep you up at night in terms of what artificial intelligence is doing around diagnoses and standards of care?
No.
Not at all.
Not even slightly. I mean, from a technology perspective, I think we're not as close to true AI as a lot of us would kind of hope.
Yep.
But I think we are in a good place on kind of algorithmic search relevance, machine learned models of the world. And Grand Rounds definitely employs a lot of that around how we do our matching, around how we do our ROI, around how we do our severity and risk adjustment and all that good stuff.
You've just described a situation where you are determining the best care possible, right? I'm a 48-year-old white male and have a shoulder surgery, and you're going to send me to Northwell, not HSS.
Right.
For some reason.
Yeah.
How are you determining that?
I'll just give you kind of a thumbnail sketch, but it's not simply about observing that you have a torn labrum or whatever you had and that this is the right sort of surgery for you. It's the right match for you as a patient based on where you are, your other comorbidities. It's the right level of availability for that physician. It's the right team of people working around the physician, the anesthesiologist, the physical therapist, et cetera. And it's really looking at their dexterity, their expertise, their volume, and their amazing, probably above anything else, clinical judgment when it comes to specifically what you need. Look, our job right now is actually to create access. Just like if we can carve off the bottom set of performers and get people moved up to the top two tiers of medicine, we will be affecting such a fundamental change on the delivery of care and the way people experiencing it.
You and I get together periodically, and I was sitting with you when you talked to me about the fact that you had lost hearing in one of your ears due to a brain tumor, which I think Grand Rounds was instrumental in helping us solve.
Yep.
What I was really struck by was you were sitting there questioning whether or not you could be who you are as a leader, as a CEO. You were going to your first conference shortly thereafter.
Yep.
You only have hearing in one ear now. And that's something that's just happened in the last year, right? A year and a half. And I just want to talk about what it is about you personally that can face that adversity and that situation where you're the leader of one of the hottest businesses, huge valuations, high profile, and suddenly you don't think you can do what you do.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you can't fucking hear people
standing
on the left side of you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
What is that like?
Yeah, and it forces you to take a huge step back. I think ultimately I'm a better leader and probably more empathetic because of this. I did not arrive at that conclusion to start. I actually was deathly afraid, well, not only of the fact that I was going to have a 12-hour brain surgery, but also that, you know, my face might not work. In this surgery, you could impact the facial nerve and then half of my face would be frozen. Not that I think I'm the world's greatest looking guy, but I do think that I need to be able to smile at people and convey enthusiasm and do my job. I always connected deeply to the patient side of this mission. I think I connect even more deeply and I can understand what it feels like. I was sharing with Steve what it felt like to be waiting in the examination room for my 1-year checkup, which just happened.
Congrats, by the way.
And thank you. And all I wanted the doctor to say was like, we're good. Like I didn't want to do the blood pressure cuff. I didn't want to wait. So much of medicine from a patient's perspective is the anxiety of finding access, the anxiety of finding out results, and the anxiety of knowing, to know that you're being well taken care of. And that's why as human beings, we quite literally go to the ends of the earth to get access to clinical trials, to get access to people who can tell us that there's a different answer for their kid. And I am incredibly proud that despite all these products I've been telling you about and the way that we've evolved as a business, that is the central philosophy that still governs Grand Rounds.
One of the things I admire most about you is that you're very thoughtful about the industry, and now you're actually an industry leader, yeah. Right? I mean, you really are with the scale of your company. Why not more exits in the digital health industry, number one? And number two, is that a problem where we stand today?
Yeah, I mean, actually, offline...
This is for all of us.
I know this is an interview of me, but I'd love offline to hear your answer to that question, Steve, because you see the data more closely than I do. But I've always worried the opposite problem was true. That there were a lot of people with great ambition and great ideas and great teams, and they were selling out too quickly to some very deep-pocketed incumbents who would rather, frankly, buy a threat
and kill
than see that monopolize. My kind of charge to my group of fellow entrepreneurs in this wave is let's try not to do that. I understand we have a fiduciary responsibility. I have, you know, accountability to my shareholders. I completely get that. But I think we've got a real shot in this wave with the presence of technology, with the presence of data, with the ability to get like employers on your side and other group buyers on your side. We have a chance at making a real difference.
All right, my last question, I ask everyone. If you weren't running Grand Rounds, what company would you love to run that exists today?
Oh, wow, that's an interesting question. And I should know this because I've listened to this podcast a bunch of times. I think JPMorgan Chase would be an amazing company.
Why?
Well, talk about another place that has amazing consumer reach, can affect communities, can help rebuild entire cities, entire institutions. Great reach to the individual, great reach to institutional folks too. So just an amazing platform to do work at scale. And I really respect them. I think they're a marvelous organization. And places that can do good at scale are deeply seductive to me.
It's interesting to hear someone who's in healthcare think about a financial institution.
Heavily regulated, but also, like you said, scale. And really, at the end of the day, healthcare and finance are what people feel every day when they go home, right?
Yep.
Thanks a lot, man.
Awesome. Yeah,
this was fun. You got it. Good to see you guys.
Yeah, you too. Let my travel be
forever in blue jeans. Thanks for listening to A Healthy Dose. Please subscribe through iTunes. And if you have any suggestions for topics or guests, email the guys at steve@bvp.com or trevor@oxyandpartners.com. We do okay forever.